Blog Talk Radio.
Saturday, April 29th, 2017 day. Good evening. Welcome to another segment of Booker T. Washington Speaks. Today, Saturday, April 29th, 2017. My name is Haleem Mustafa, and I'm here in this beautiful campus of Berkeley University here in Northern California. And we have a very exciting show today for you, a very serious topic to be discussed. And so the topic, I'll say in advance of the discussion, is why do the African American community need HBCUs to continue to survive and prosper in the 21st century? But before we begin, again, I'd like to introduce myself, Haleem Mustafa, and in the tradition that we do with this program here, we like to open in prayer. If you just abide with me, we'll say a prayer, and we'll introduce our host and moderator, Dr. Marshall Washington Abui. With the name of God, most gracious, most merciful, praise be to God, cherisher and sustainer of the worlds, most gracious, most merciful, master of the day of judgment, thee alone do we worship, and thy aid do we seek. Show us the straight way, the way on those who thou hast bestowed thy grace, whose portion is not wrath, and who go not astray. Amen. This is a very, very unique, serious time that we're in right now, and we have to start doing things to get ourselves in a prosperous mode. So I'd like to say that I'm here as a co-host, and our host and moderator is, I mentioned, Dr. Booker T. Washington's great-grandson, Marshall Washington Abui. And again, the question is posed is why do the African community need HBCUs to continue to survive and prosper in the 21st century? So we're going to have a great time here, and on the campus where I'm at right now, there's a lot of young people that I'm certainly going to be making an inquiry to get their opinion. And I'd like to certainly encourage you all in the listening audience to make your points known here, and we'll have a great conversation. So I'd like to bring on our host and moderator, Dr. Marshall Washington Abui, please. I guess I need to say one more time, if he's not available, I'll continue on. I'm going to say, Dr. Washington, are you available, sir, at the moment here?
Yes, I am. Yes, I am. Thank you. Thank you very much.
Okay.
Can you hear me? Can you hear me? Hello? Can you hear me, Brother Mustafa?
I can hear you loud and clear, sir.
Okay, good. Yes, well, to all of our guests this evening who are listening via the internet. I don't see any call-ins to participate in the show, but hopefully some of the people that are there where you are in the venue where you are, Brother Mustafa, will be able to participate. We'd like to give their views on the topic. I just want to begin by welcoming all that are listening via the internet, and I want to give you the preface to the show, and this is what we want to talk about. First of all, most HBCUs, meaning historically black colleges and universities today, are facing an uphill struggle to stay open. The HBCU college presidency, once considered to be the most prestigious occupation in the African American community, is now seen as a career landmine, even where the slightest misstep can be a career terminator. As the best and the brightest African American scholars are increasingly being recruited with full ride, lucrative 4-year scholarships by historically white colleges and universities, some are even questioning the need for the HBCUs, the historically black colleges and universities, except as a place to try to educate those students that need special remediation as scholars. So we invite everyone who may be listening via the internet at this time to join us to call the number 657-383-0671. Again, 657-383-0671. I'll repeat it again in a few minutes if you need time to get paper and a pen or pencil. But we invite you to join us as we discuss the question of why does the African-American community need the HBCUs to continue to survive and to prosper in the 21st century. And rather than have a panel of experts discuss this issue, we encourage everyone to join in and let us all hear what you think. And so that is the preface to the program. I just want to make a few comments, and I'll turn it back over to our co-host, Brother Mustafa, Halim Mustafa, who is also known as Dr. Halim Mustafa, the Doctor of Self-Esteem, which is an honorable title. We definitely uphold that. We know him to be a very honorable person and very esteemed by many people, and certainly deserving of the credit of being a doctor, meaning a healer of self-esteem. So with that said, I just want to share something with you as we await others who may come on. This may be a little bit controversial, what I'm getting ready to read, but I'm quoting from my book, which I recently published. Actually, was published at the end of 2015, entitled Booker T. Washington and the Black Revolution. And it says that in his, first of all, let's go ahead and begin at the beginning. The title of this particular chapter is The Education of a Slave. Very poignant and controversial way to start a chapter, I agree. But this is my book, so I'm taking it the way I wrote it and sharing it with you. First of all, for the purpose of this definition, we will be using the term slave within the context of a civil relationship in which one person has absolute power over the life, fortune, and liberty of another. Term education, we will explain it as cultivation. Cultivation means development. Thus, the topic of this chapter is the development of a civil relationship in which one group of people in America exercises absolute power over the life, fortune, and liberty of another group of people. As a people, this is the situation in which the African American people have been in for the past 450 plus years in this country, because legally we are free, except for the nearly 1 million of us that are incarcerated in jails or prisons. We are free slaves by definition. What is this dilemma caused by? What is this dilemma caused by? One thing that has caused it is our appetite for following the guidance of our enemies that have enslaved us in relationship to the way that we live and the gods that we worship. The Honorable Elijah Muhammad teaches us in The Theology of Time, a book that was published that was a compilation of speeches that he gave during the summer of 1972 at the Mosque Miriam in Chicago, which at that time was called Mosque Number 2, and later by Imam Wallace D. Muhammad was named the Honorable Elijah Muhammad Mosque, and the Honorable Minister Louis Farrakhan renamed it Mosque Miriam, and it's actually the centerpiece of the honor of the Honorable Louis Farrakhan's movement, the Nation of Islam. But the Honorable Elijah Muhammad said, when a man isn't afraid to break the law of God, which isn't good, then he's defying God to bring about his execution to him for breaking the law, because he's disregarding it. He doesn't like it, and he goes back to the enemy of God to join up with him again. Some of you think that you still have the freedom to do as you please. You can't continue doing as you please in this world, because Allah is erasing this world. So you will have no place to carry on your evil. The other people, they're all righteous, and they won't allow you to live in their righteous world with your evil from the devil of this world, of whom they are destroying. This is the righteous people. You can't hold on to this. This is what I'm telling you. You are not free to hold on to it. You are not free to act. Yes, this is a free world, granting you the freedom of doing like the world does. But in the next world coming, you won't be free to do anything you want to do. You will have to do just one thing, and that's what that world's rules and laws and regulations bring to us. And he goes on to say, God in the Holy Quran in Surah 3, verse 179, the title of the surah is Ali Imran, says, quote, let not the believers think that our respite or our time of giving them a chance to repent to them is good for themselves. We grant them respite that they may grow in their wickedness, but they will have a shame for punishment, unquote. He continues, or this is the writing of myself continuing, part of the education of the slave to make him and her continue to remain opposed to God's plan for their true freedom and their release from their enemies is to instill in our people a continuing feeling of racial inferiority. Historian E. Franklin Frazier noted that, quote, during the more than two centuries of enslavement by the white man, every means was employed to stamp a feeling of natural inferiority in the Negro soul. This is by Dr. E. Franklin Frazier, who said this, that during the more than two centuries of enslavement by the white man, every means was employed to stamp a feeling of natural inferiority in the Negro soul. Christianity and the Bible were utilized to prove, both to prove and to give divine sanction to his alleged racial inferiority, or as some contended, his exclusion from the races of mankind. In his classic, The Black Bourgeoisie, Dr. Frazier noted that, quote, the black bourgeoisie, and this is mostly who is being produced by the historically black colleges and universities, as well as the white colleges and universities that educate young black people, this class of black people called the black bourgeoisie. He says that the black bourgeoisie are the middle class educated Negroes, the element which has striven more than any element among Negroes to make itself ever in the image of the white man exhibits most strikingly the inferiority complex of those who would escape their racial identification. And we just want to read a few more lines. Dr. Frazier further reports that the enslavement of the Negro in the United States destroyed not only his family and his household gods, it effaced whatever memories of the African homeland that had survived the Middle Passage. The destruction of the common tradition and religious beliefs and practices reduced the Negro to a mere atom without a personality or a social identity. And then I want to share this last part, and we'll be finished, and I'll turn back over to Brother Ali Mustafa, our co-host. Dr. Frazier said that, and then I continue by saying, after destroying the African's link to a cultural and religious heritage and treating him as a mere brute fit only for labor, it was determined during the closing years of the 18th century to allow missionaries to come from the Baptist and Methodist churches to come under strict conditions to instill more racial inferiority teaching in the minds of African slaves, the African slaves, by making them believe through their preaching from the Bible that his enslavement and her enslavement was due to the fact that he or she had been cursed by God. His very color was a sign of the curse which he had received as a descendant of Ham, Noah's son. Parts of the Bible, remember, Negro slaves could not be taught to read the Bible for themselves. It was against the law. This was the beginning of the education of a free slave. We're going to stop right there, and we want to talk about historically what has happened to our people that have been educated in historically black colleges and universities. I just want to say this. During the time right after the Civil War, there were many missionaries that were sent by organizations like the American Missionary Society and the American Colonization Society, even, whose purpose it was to basically instill in the newly freed Africans a sense of wanting to be part of a free people, either for the purpose of remaining in America as a underclass of free people that would look up to the previous masters for food, clothing, and shelter, and would be at the beck and call of the agricultural magnates of the reviving South after the war, or the industrial magnates of the North, who had the intention of bringing to the South new industries to help the South rebuild, and using the black people to do the lower echelon type of labor in these industries. The fact is that there were others that the American Colonization Society represented that wanted to send the Negroes to Africa, but wanted to prepare them to still be puppets of the American government, even though they would be living in Africa, particularly in the American-designed colony of Liberia. So we had these schools that were basically teaching white superiority. The studies that these students had in history were not the history of the great kingdoms of Mali and Songhai and Timbuktu, to the great university there in Mali, or the great kingdom of Benin, or Dahomey, or Ghana, or Nigeria, or Gambia, or Senegal. But they were not taught these things. They were taught about England and France and Germany and Greece and Rome, etc., so that our people would see these people from these countries as being higher in cultivation and higher in advancement as far as human development was concerned than they were. And of course, we have many, many examples of how our graduates from the colleges themselves looked at the black people that did not have the college degrees as being really on a very low scale of humanity. and began to imitate the thinking of the white people that had designed their education concerning the lower class, you might say, of the black people that didn't have the education that the so-called talented 10th had. Now, there was another side of that coin, and I'm going to say this and I'll move on and let Brother Halim make comments. Not let him, but ask him to make comments. Pardon me. Booker T. Washington saw the need for industrial education coupled with a very strong basic foundation of liberal arts education to instill in the African Americans a sense of self-sufficiency and independence and competitiveness to be able to compete with the whites, especially in the South. And I'm going to come back to this in a few minutes. I've said a lot, but the point that I'm trying to make is that you had a certain agenda for black people that was represented in many of the colleges and universities that were begun as HBCUs to prepare a group of black people that were going to basically be representatives of white superiority over the masses of black people. And then you had on the other side of the coin, the schools like Hampton Institute and Tuskegee that were built to help black people develop a sense of pride and also a sense of equality and self-sufficiency and certainly not a sense of inferiority or being puppets for the white establishment. So with that said, I'm going to go ahead and I'm going to conclude my part and ask Brother Halim Mustafa if you'd like to go ahead and share this discussion with comments.
Yes, sir. Yes, sir. From a firsthand bird's eye view here, in the university environment here at the Berkeley, on the streets here, I see a mix of students of different ethnic groups, and I've been analyzing it in terms of how the black students respond here on this campus environment, and I find that they are always in the back of the group, not necessarily leading, walking in a direction that others will follow. That kind of perplexes me a little bit because it seems that they always follow in other people, and that's just kind of a symptom of what you explained, sir. It's a symptom of that not wanting to take leadership and show others that you have a little more to offer. Otherwise, you just follow them and respond to their jokes instead of yourself being free enough to have jokes and fun. In contrast, you look at the HBCU environment of where black students are nurturing each other. You find a different attitude and behavior that's fun-oriented, and it helps people to loosen up a bit and certainly make friends a little easier. Where in this environment here, as I'm looking, it seems that there's no smiles on the faces of these African-American students. There's only the idea of, you know, serious focus, but this is a weekend now. You're supposed to loosen up sometime. So I think that it's very relevant what you read, sir, in your book and the thing that you explained. We have to figure out how we can make these universities in the private and the state system be a little bit more receptive to the African-American students and a little more nurturing, because there is a situation where the isolation of not having the ethnic culture be having some presence on campus, it makes them feel inferior. So that's my comment at this point, sir, and I'm just observing the students here walking this Saturday evening, and I'll be trying to grab some and ask them to join us in this conversation and see what they have to say as well. That's it, sir.
Well, that's great. I appreciate that observation. As you know, I attended Berkeley for a period of three different matriculations, covering a period of nearly 3 years, beginning there as a 17-year-old freshman right out of high school, and then returning as a junior and continuing until 1970 during the period where I transitioned into the Nation of Islam under the leadership of the Honorable Elijah Muhammad. And there was a lot of turmoil going on the campus there during that period of time. Those who were there had a very different kind of experience than the students probably that you're looking at, because there were constant events of turmoil where the students were protesting against different things. I remember being involved with what was called the Third World Revolution Movement. Revolution was one of the words that came easily from the lips of black students at that time, because we were, you might say, disciples of Malcolm X, and he, of course, had encouraged the revolutionaries of Africa, such as Patrice Lumumba and Abdel Gamal Nasser and other people who were rebelling against colonialization by the Europeans, and particularly the British and the French. And so we were reading books such as The Wretched of the Earth by the noted black psychologist from French colonial and Algeria, Dr. Franz Fanon. We were also reading books by people that represented the socialist mindset. Some of the Black Panthers at that time were selling on the campus of Berkeley the red book of Mao Zedong. Some of us read it. I didn't read it. I was never interested in anything that had to do with communism. I had grown up in a Catholic school environment where the idea of communism was anathema to the Catholic Church, because we were taught that the communists did not believe in God, that they were a godless society, and so they were totally antithetical to the Catholic religion. And then having gone into the army and been right at the, what we would say, frontier of North and South Korea in battle dress, I was conditioned to prepare myself to be attacked by the communist armies from North Korea. In fact, they were so close where they would use psychological warfare, and in the evenings, late at night, or starting around the time it got dark, they would start broadcasting threats to us over loud speakers and trying to put fear in us that they were going to attack us. And so I developed an attitude that I didn't want to have anything to do with the communists. And so even though a lot of the people that I knew at Berkeley, the young black students, were beginning to feel somewhat of an attraction to socialism, and especially with the promotion from the Black Panther Party of this communistic literature, I didn't have anything to do with it. But the fact is that there was a fever, there was a high, what I would say, amount of interest in change. The black students had decided that the education that we were getting at Berkeley was not really effectively preparing us for black leadership in the world of change in America. Post-civil rights, what was called the Black Power time in black history. And we felt that what we were getting in the college at Berkeley wasn't helping us to get where we need to go to become that talented 10th leadership core that Du Bois speaks about. So we began to press the administration to give us more relevant classes. In fact, we even petitioned the school to set up a Black Studies College within the structure of the Multiversity, which is the University of California at Berkeley. And, of course, that was flatly turned down. But we began to protest, to have demonstrations in front of Sproul Hall. You're not far from there, the main administrative building on the campus. And it attracted attention from the national press. And so the administration relented somewhat and said that if they could find qualified faculty, they would set up a Black Studies department. But then the Chicanos and the Asians
got involved, and they got on our coattails, you might say, because they wanted the same kind of relevant education for their own needs. So they joined us with us, and we formed the Third World Liberation Movement. That went fairly well. There were some rough spots there because we didn't have the same agendas they had. But by our combining our forces, we were able to get the college to agree to setting up an ethnic studies department. And that was a step ahead farther than what we had in the past. But the point is that all of us were on different levels. Some were frustrated. Some were satisfied. Some just wanted to get that University of California, Berkeley degree, to get a white collar job in a Fortune 500 company, or to graduate and go to Boat Hall Law School, which is a very prestigious law school, to be able to get with a white firm, or maybe to have the kind of prestigious law degree that would help them attract some of the upper scale black clients in that neighborhood of the Bay Area and California in general. So I'm saying all this to say that my experience at Berkeley was actually a very mixed bag because I felt isolated. You mentioned about the black students being behind. We weren't even behind. We were like on a whole different playing field. When I went there as a freshman in 1961, there were 300 black students out of 30,000 students on the campus, and it was like we didn't even exist. No special attention was given to us. We had our own group that met down in the student cafe in the building called the Student Union Building, ASUC, Associated Students of the University of California, down in the basement. There's a place that was there then, and I remember when we returned there, Brother Haleem, back in 2001, it was still there, the Bear's Lair. And from being from seeing on the internet recently, at least in the last two or three years, that it's still there. Well, that's where we hung out, and that's generally where we saw each other, because many of the students lived in the community. Berkeley then did not have any dormitories. I don't know if it does now, but the students lived out in the black community. The black students did. So we only generally saw each other on campus because we didn't even really party together as a rule, because some of the students had contacts with the high schools they went to before they came to Berkeley in that area, and they partied with their old friends. But I personally felt very much alone. And when
I'm here,
I left
sir.
There, yeah, okay. You hear me? Do you hear me?
Yes, sir, loud and clear. I
Hello?
Hear you loud and clear, sir.
Okay, well, I'm just telling a little story.
I hear you loud and
I'm
clear.
Just telling
I hear,
you,
can I talk?
I'm just, no, I'm not friends.
Okay, go ahead, sir. I'm sorry. I thought you wanted me to come in.
No, no, I'm not friends. I want to finish. I'm telling a little story.
Go ahead, sir. Yes, sir.
I'm saying that when I left Berkeley, I went to Tuskegee after getting out of the Army. And I was in a historically black college for 2 years as a freshman and sophomore, and I became the president of my class, which is something I probably would not have done if I had been at Berkeley. Not only that, but I became a member of a fraternity. They didn't have any black fraternities on campus at Berkeley, so I couldn't become a member of a fraternity at Berkeley my first time around. When I went back, I found that the San Jose State College campus had a chapter of the black fraternity, the Omega Psi Phi fraternity, and they allowed me as a Berkeley student, along with two other Berkeley students, to pledge through the San Jose State chapter. But there was very, very little until around 1967 that black people could do to really identify as a community on that campus, as opposed to being at Tuskegee, where I was immersed in a black world, a community of black scholars. And I'm just saying that in answer to the question that I asked about the survival of black colleges to get to that, I definitely feel that black colleges are important and that they are needed. I greatly benefited from the roles that I played on the campus of Tuskegee. Not only was, not to be boasting, but not only was I president of my class, but I was also the director of a government-funded educational program, actually the co-director, which provided scholarships, full scholarships, to 100 students that I personally was involved with recruiting to come to Tuskegee, even went into some of their homes in the counties around Tuskegee and interviewed them with their families and processed their applications. And these students were very largely successful in completing the first year at Tuskegee because of our working with them, mentoring them, and providing a tutorial program for them. These kinds of things were not happening at most of the white colleges in 1965 and 1966. So just these examples are a reason why I think that we should continue to encourage students to go to black colleges so that they will have that identity, that sense of being special, that sense of being somebody important in the world. So I'll close at that note, Brother Halim, and I'll turn it back over to you.
Yeah, yes, sir, Dr. Marshall. Very, very, very good story there. It's interesting, that nurturing that took place at the college level at the Tuskegee for you. I had experience at a high school level, and I see that the high school levels here in California, Northern California, there was that era that you're talking about, and I was at a white school, Sequoia High School, and there was a disconnect because I was being bussed in. I was being bussed in a lot with other students, black students there. And there was a counselor there, Mr. George Collins, and he started organizing us to have, again, a government within a government at the white school, which gave us that feeling that, of being contributing to something that's important to us as a cultural group. And I saw that as a nurturing for college. Even though I didn't go to a college, and I'm planning to go back into school, but the thing is that that nurturing that took place really gave a lot of credence to the pride that was being expressed. And we had plays of Pearly Victorious and other plays that we would do, and get us who had a really shy nature, I was one of them, and be able to get rid of the shyness in learning how to stand and talk and socialize as a group of people who didn't really have a socialization experience with each other before, because we came from different feeder schools, junior schools leading to the high school. So there was not a lot of familiarity with each other. But what took place with that government within a government structure, it kind of gave us the opportunity to communicate with each other, and a lot of friendships were established. And a lot of we found that we had a lot more in common with each other than we thought we didn't have, because a lot of times the conditioning it begins early in terms of how you condition people not to want to communicate with their cultural group. This is something that we have to find solutions to at every level. That's the point I'm making here. So from the elementary schools, there's certain things that take place. The junior school, junior high schools, there's certain things that take place. The high schools, there's certain things that take place. College, there's certain things that take place. We're talking about a progression of building up the leadership of the young people. That's what needs to happen. And so at the college level, certainly you find the athletes, superstars, and they're modified their behavior to fit into the system, right? They go to the community back home. They laugh and they're feeling good about themselves, and they can perform better in athletic performance with this certain feeling about, you know, having fun and just, you know, wiping out the opponents that they're playing against. But when they're under the pressure of playing for the white coaches, they lose that spirit of, like, this independent creativity, this explosion of, saying, manhood, you know, and just becoming docile to the point of waiting for instructions to turn on the juice, and they know how to play the sport all their life. Not only in the sports realm, but in the classroom setting, you'll find that thing happen. And so, you know, the point is that the need for the HBCUs is critical. I just like to see them take it to a level of taking some, toning down a little bit of the fun and amping up a little bit more of the responsibility. That's what I would say. Tone down the fun just a little bit, whether that we don't become with the sororities and fraternities fighting against each other, because there is competition where I've seen on the campus sorority and fraternity members fighting against their counterparts on the campus. So that becomes an alarm for me that there's somewhat of a disfocus of what is the social responsibility that we come to college for, and that we certainly want to continue in the legacy of what our ancestors here in this country have suffered, died for, you know. And so I just see us have to revamp a little bit, but it's very important. That's the point I want to make, sir.
That's good. Can you hear me all right?
Loud and clear.
Okay. Well, I want to get back to the main question, because I think it's important that our community have a discussion around this particular question. You've addressed it to some extent, but I'd like to continue with some things on this topic. Why? Why does the African-American community, the community of African-Americans, need the HBCUs? Why does the African-American community need the HBCUs to continue to survive, understanding that most HBCUs today are facing an uphill struggle to stay open? So in that light, why does the African-American community need the HBCUs to continue to stay open, to survive, and to prosper in the 21st century? That is the question. Now, I just want to address that from this particular perspective. First of all, I don't necessarily believe that all the HBCUs are going to survive. I was very hurt over a decade ago, maybe two decades ago, when Morris Brown College in Atlanta basically closed down. They lost their accreditation and their enrollment went down to maybe just a couple of hundred students. So many of the programs were shut down, and the students that remain, I don't know what type of services that they had. But the fact is, for all practical purposes, Morris Brown was closed down, even though technically I guess it wasn't. But me, because I had spent hours, countless hours, on the campus of Morris Brown College. I was very proud of Morris Brown College. It was a good school. I had friends that attended Morris Brown College, and so it was certainly painful for me to see it go away in practical terms. And now here in Augusta, Georgia, we have Payne College, who is in a very dire situation. Regional accrediting agency revoked its accreditation. That's a court battle now that's going on to try to save its accreditation. But in the final analysis, the issues that caused it to be considered, and I hate to say it like this, but be considered not eligible or not worthy to be a member of this Southern Association of Colleges and Schools, those factors are not really going to go away in the near future because they're basically financial. And there are other schools that Wilberforce University, many others, Grambling, Southern, Texas Southern, even Florida A&M. These schools have had serious questions raised by the people that are accrediting these schools as whether or not they can measure up to the increasingly rigorous standards for being accredited by the bodies that really require that a school be accredited by in order for their students to get into the more prestigious graduate schools, law schools, and medical schools. But I personally feel that the black colleges general need to remain, and this is the reason why. A student that goes to college is preparing for experiences that will have very, very far-reaching and long-term effects in one's life. If a student goes to college and graduates just on a general basis, not that this happens for every student, that student is going to generally, except for the exceptions that are in the entertainment world and the sports world that make it, but generally that student is going to live in a cleaner neighborhood, in a larger, more well-equipped home, is going to be able to trade out and get newer cars on a more regular basis, which is going to allow that person to have the freedom to make more trips with his family to visit relatives without having to go through the hassle of catching planes or riding on what is becoming an uncomfortable experience nowadays in many cases, riding on the Amtrak service. And I remember years ago when riding on a train used to be one of the greatest pleasures in the world, but it's not so pleasurable now as it used to be. So to have a nice luxury car, SUV, or a luxury sedan, or a minivan, or whatever, to travel 1,500 miles, if the case requires it, or at least 500 or 600 miles, is an option that requires a nice car. And the upper middle class black people have these options. And what provides most of them with these options is that they have employment as a result of their college degrees. Now, that's kind of ironic because that may be changing. I talked to a friend of mine yesterday who used to be an Army recruiter, and he told me that in his Army recruiting experience, he had the occasion to interview people that represented Fortune 500 companies to find out what the opportunities were for those people that came out of the Army that had college degrees from black schools to get good jobs with these companies. And I was shocked when he told me just recently, just yesterday, that they told him that they didn't want to hire students with degrees from black colleges. And I was shocked because, you know, the black colleges, especially schools like Tuskegee and other prestigious schools, Hampton, I'm sure, and others, Lincoln University and Xavier University, Wilberforce University, Central State, and all these colleges, I think they take pride in being able to tell their students that if they graduate, that they're going to have people in these corporations holding the door open for them. But in reality, I can't really verify that. I know it was held open for me. But I think the reason why it was held open for me, strangely enough, after spending 2 years at Tuskegee getting a Fortune 500 corporation executive type job was because I belonged to a white college fraternity, and the person that was doing the hiring was very fascinated and happy to welcome a fraternity brother to that corporation. If I had only had my Omega Psi Phi affiliation, which I hadn't completed pledging in Omega Psi Phi at that time, I don't think I would have gotten that job, not as readily as I got it, because I had that white connection. So I'm just saying that the real answer today in the 21st century, in my opinion, is not for the colleges, the black colleges, to take pride in prying open the doors for black students that graduate to go to work for white college, white corporations. In fact, I think that the black colleges need to do what Tuskegee did in its early years and prepare black students to go to work for black industries, because the white colleges are preparing the white students to go to work for white-owned industries. The Japanese colleges are preparing their graduates, even the ones that they send to schools like Berkeley, to go to work for Japanese industries. And so that was the point of my initial talk when we first started the show, and that we shouldn't be so dependent on other people providing us with jobs as the result of us being trained by these black schools. So if the black schools can change their mindset and see their job as preparing black students to establish industries and prepare students to go to work in those industries, then I think they have quite a bit of real validity and purpose. I'm finished for now.
Yes, sir. Dr. Marshall, that's really, really profound. And that what you just presented. Yesterday, I had a conversation with a Caucasian lady about AIG Insurance Company, where she works at as a sales executive, and she told me that they have young white people coming in, young student white students coming in, and automatically say that they looking for management positions, management position, first time into the work world, right? Because they feel so privileged. Now, in contrary to what you said about what is the need for the black students at the HBCU colleges and the colleges themselves to take on a bigger role as providing industry opportunities by creating them, it's critical because, you know, if we're not going to – we have some brilliant people, African-American students, black students. I know a lot of them, genius-wise. But if nobody is offering or setting up the infrastructures to support – business, social entrepreneurship development, with the ideas of, you know, managing societies, so we don't have our societies falling apart at the seams because of gentrification conspiracy, sir. So I know for sure that what your great grandfather did was profound, and today you see that we don't even have the common sense to look after the social development interests of our young people. I'll give you an example, sir. I was working. I was at a gymnasium in my community, all black community, and it was raining this day, and there was a group of white men who were playing in the basketball court, full court, amongst themselves, and there was a group of say about maybe 5 or 6 African American youth under say 12. For sure, they weren't 15. And they were playing in the rain, and there was a gentleman that was a very, you know, knowledgeable man who worked, who founded EOC in San Mateo County. His name is Ed Bex, and he told me, he said, you know what, these children are showing us exactly what we need to do. Now he says these white people over here playing, and he's married to a white woman, so he's not racist. He's just talking practical. He says these white men over here, they playing in our gym, full court. And they got a gym over there in their community where they can go play at. And in our community, the young kids are in the rain, playing in the rain. So they're showing us exactly what we need to do. And that was profound. And I say the same thing in the academic set, that there's a lot of people who have business ideas, but they don't have the trained minds themselves to carry them out and develop them. So they need these college-educated students who are, you know, very knowledgeable about the current new trends of you know, business development, especially with this internet aspect of it and all the social media and all these things. And so if we don't have our students coming out of these HBCU colleges with opportunities extended from those African Americans in the community, then we are just assimilating into the white infrastructure, and therefore we are powerless, and we continue to be fodder for the system. And they can throw us out anytime they want to, just change the policy. It says no more people with curly hair, or no more people with braided hair, or no more people with dark skin. It's quite easily. And that's something that I want to bring up as well. I was flying here yesterday from Texas here to California, and there was an African-American woman, very distinguished and beautiful and articulate, intelligent. Her name was Isis. And she was telling me how in Texas she was, they arrested her for braiding hair. And she did, there was no law in the books that said there was something that that couldn't happen. And she actually had been on news media, and they'd done a lot of stories on her, even Forbes magazine. And she wasn't charged, but they kept her from working for 30 years earning income to take care of her four kids, her four young kids then, who are now grown. So there's been several people, well, actually, there's been a lot of information media-wise. What I'm referencing, alluding here to here, is that when we do get in business, there's also things that stop us there. So there's a lot of things that we got to look at a multiple level. It's not just one dimension. There's probably like 10 dimensions or 20 or 30 or maybe 1,000 to figure out all these different loopholes that we can work within the system to create our own system. Otherwise, we're not using the intelligence that God gave a goose, right, or God gave an animal that knows that how to survive and prosper within their own world. So we are not in our own world. We are in somebody else's world. And I'm saying this, that this world belongs to God, but a lot of people feel like it's their world, and they dominate the media, they dominate the society, and they're not really the dominant in terms of the cultural of the planet. They're not the dominant culture of the planet, but they use the media to make themselves look like super giants, and people who don't have the knowledge to see that they're being what you call subliminally influenced to be inferior, turn out to be inferior, and then they started to reflect this inferiority in the minds and the community of the children, then we have a cycle of cyclic reverse cycle of success, and it becomes a cyclic failure of success, sir. And that's my comments for now.
Okay, well, for those that may be just tuning in, I want to refresh the conversational topic, and I'll just reiterate what I said at the beginning for those that may be just joining in. Most HBCUs, meaning historically black colleges and universities today, are facing an uphill struggle to stay open. The HBCU college presidency, once considered to be the most prestigious occupation in the African American community, is now seen by many as a career landmine, where even the slightest misstep can be a career terminator. As the best and the brightest African American scholars are increasingly being recruited with full ride, lucrative 4-year scholarships, full ride meaning all expenses paid, tuition, room and board, and fees, etc., being recruited by historically white colleges and universities, some are even questioning the need for HBCUs, except as a place to try to educate those that need special remediation as scholars. And so the topic question is, why does the African-American community need the HBCUs to continue to survive? That's what, for those that are just joining, that's what we're discussing here. Why does the African-American community need the HBCUs to survive and to prosper in the 21st century? Having said that, I want to share something with our audience from a book by the Honorable Elijah Muhammad, a classic book entitled Message to the Black Man in America, under the subtopic of Help Self, What Must Be Done with the Negroes. The Honorable Elijah Muhammad teaches us that since our being brought in chains to the shores of America, our brain power, labor, skills, talent, and wealth have been taken, given, and spent toward building and adding to the civilization of another people. It is time for you and me, the so-called Negroes, to start doing for ourselves. We must not let our children be as we are, beggars of another man for his home, for his facilities, for his clothing, food, and the means of providing a living. Man depends on land for the necessities, food, clothing, and shelter for survival. A prime requisite for freedom and independence is having one's own land. There can be no freedom without a people having their own land. The acquisition of land has been the factor for more wars than any other cause. Economists agree that in order for any type of nation or system, capitalism, communism, democracy, or totalitarian, or what have you, to exist and have a degree of independence, there must be ownership of land. The so-called Negroes are without a state that they can call their own. We have nothing to show for our more than 310 years of forced slave labor and more than 100 years, now 150 years, of our free servitude to our slave master's children. We were brought here to work. We have worked. We are still the workers. Some of us say, what will we do if we do not work for the white man? How will we live? The Honorable Elijah Muhammad said, when you're free and independent, you have a job. You have a tremendous task of doing something for self. You have the job of building a civilization for yourself, as other free and independent people are doing for themselves. As a people, we must become producers and not remain consumers and employees. We must be able to extract raw materials from the earth and to manufacture them into something useful for ourselves. This would create jobs in production. We must remember that without land, there is no production. The surplus of what we produce, we would sell. This would develop a field of commerce and trade, as other free and independent people, whose population is less than that of the then 20 million, now in excess of 40 million, so-called Negroes who are dependent in America. We must begin at the cradle and teach our babies. We must begin at the cradle and teach our babies that they must do something for self. They must be not like we are, their fathers and mothers, who look to the slave masters and slave master's children for everything. We must teach our children now with an enthusiasm exceeding that which our slave masters used in having our forefathers and mothers embed the seed of dependency within us. We must stop the process of giving our brain power, labor, and wealth to our slave master's children. We must eliminate the master-slave relationship. We must educate ourselves and our children into the rich power of knowledge, which has elevated every people who have sought and used it. We must give the benefit of our knowledge to the elevation of our own people. We must give the benefit of our knowledge to the elevation of our own people. Presently, in this country, in almost all of the major universities and colleges, there are thousands of young students from Africa and Asia. Yet, as young and primitive and backwards as we say these countries of Africa and Asia might be, their students here are returning to their shores. Their intent and purpose is to give their people the benefit of their learning, to give their people the benefit of their learning. All civilized people give the benefit of their knowledge, skill, and wealth to their own people. Those who do not are called traitors, defectors, spies, tools, and toms. Why should we spend 12 and 16 years seeking, or more actually, seeking an education only to give the benefit of our knowledge back to the ones we sought it from? It is time for us to wake up. Why should we work to give the meager earnings of our labor back to our slave master's children? Why can't we have our own? Why can't we do for our own? Why can't we strive toward keeping our brain power, our labor, and our wealth within and among and elevating our own? We must have that which will make us want to do for ourselves as other people want and do for themselves. And this evening, it's not my intention to go 2 hours. I had changed the format to say that we would go an hour, and if we had people that were calling in that wanted to speak, that had comments they wanted to share, we would go as long as it took, up to 2 hours, so everyone would have his or her say. But we haven't actually had any callers tonight, so that we need to extend the time. But I do want to share this, and I'll turn it over to Brother Mustafa for some closing comments, and you can make them as long as you like. But I'm looking at a book published by Tuskegee University, and it is very, 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 very uplifting. The compilers or editors are a lady who died last year. Her name was Mrs. Amelia Boynton Robinson. She was one of the mainstay of mainstay people of Tuskegee. I didn't really get to know her personally, but I've learned a lot about her over the last 3 or 4 years. And another lady by the name of Amelia Amakai. And in this book, there are many pictures. It's actually a picture book with some very, very important information attached to the pictures. And I'm going to show you through explaining some things here. It says, for one thing, it says, there's a picture of people with new trees that they're getting ready to plant. And it says, these are workers. This is, you know, many years ago. It says, as this photograph indicates, saplings and small trees were introduced to jumpstart growth in the more aggressive phase of reforestation in damaged areas. It doesn't say what caused the damage, but the point here is that the people that were tied in with the Tuskegee University, and I'm sure under the guidance of Dr. George Washington Carver, were involved in reforesting areas that needed to have trees replanted. In fact, just to mention, one of my relatives, a second cousin of mine, who was the director of the George Washington Carver Foundation, a research project that was partially funded by the Ford Foundation in Tuskegee, his name was Dr. James H.M. Henderson. He was very much involved in reforestation efforts. And I remember as a child, he was the leader of the Boy Scout troop in Tuskegee. And one of the things that I did was to earn the Eagle Scout award rank, and the part of that was to earn a merit badge in forestry. And part of the requirement for that forestry merit badge was that I had to help to reforest an area of the forest. And so he got saplings and took myself and several other Boy Scouts out to some land that my grandmother owned, actually, and showed us how to actually plant trees. And again, he was the director of the George Washington Carver Foundation at Tuskegee, a very strong, strong disciple of George Washington Carver. He had his doctorate degree in botany, following in the footsteps of Dr. Carver. But this picture is very inspiring because it lets us know how jobs can be made available even today. Funds can be gotten through grants to employ people right now. Macon County and Tuskegee are suffering from an economic crisis. Many people are unemployed, but yet here's a way that people can make jobs for themselves. Some of the scholars at Tuskegee who are experienced in writing grants could write a grant to get money to buy the instruments, the utensils, tools, and even tractors to prepare land to plant trees that can be probably given to them by the Department of Agriculture. So there's no need for us to be unemployed when there's so much to be done. Then there's another picture, and I'm not going to give you everything in the book, of people that look like they were firefighters. I'm looking to see what the picture says in general. But this is a picture of nurses, and it looks like firefighters that worked at the Veterans Administration Hospital, all African Americans, very proud and erect, dignified-looking people that were involved in preparing a way that veterans could return to good health, or at least to be given the necessary facilities for rehabilitation. And then we get into the school itself, and I see all of these beautiful buildings. They look like buildings that you would see at an Ivy League school, at Harvard University. They were built by the students. Bricks were made by the students. Nails were made by the students in the blacksmith shops, and the bricks were made in kilns that were built and operated by students. Gorgeous looking, elegant Ivy League school type buildings. We have so many schools today that are in disrepair. I can't ever forget going to Fisk University about 30 years ago, back in the 80s, and seeing the disrepair of some of the historic buildings at this wonderfully prestigious black college, Fisk University. And I'm thinking that in the days of Booker T. Washington, he would have sent students in the brick masonry trade to Fisk to fix those buildings, because he was on the board of trustees at Fisk. So we have so much opportunity that the black colleges are not taking advantage of, primarily because they're not teaching the students to be independent. Here we have a picture of students dressed in suits, or actually suit ties, and the professor has on a lab coat with a vest and a tie. The students have vests and ties, and they're working in the upholstery department. And this was during the lifetime of Booker T. Washington. They're being trained how to make furniture and upholster furniture. Think of the great amount of production and productivity that could be produced in the black community if students had factories producing upholstered furniture. We have another one where we have students that are sitting with Dr. George Washington Carver, and these are his associate faculty members. And all of these men, even though they're essentially farmers, they look like college professors the way they're dressed. I am just sharing this with you, my audience, because I think if we want to see the black colleges continue, we need to give them a redefined purpose. Their initial purpose, though some may not be aware of it, was to basically tamp down the rebellious spirit of the college, of the uneducated people, rather, that did not have the opportunity to go to college, but wanted to force change on the conditions that surrounded them, that were oppressing them. And so the college people who were put into the high schools and the grade schools were basically taught to help these students to try to become comfortable with whatever crumbs that they were able to get working in warehouses, on the railroads, and then other menial and lower paying type jobs, which is quite different from what Booker T. Washington was teaching them. He was teaching them to establish industries where they could be the owners and managers and not be working in menial jobs, even though he did not tell people that was not good to work in menial jobs. But he said you should always be preparing yourself to excel and to go to the top in whatever you are doing. So I just want to share with you the fact that there's a great opportunity if we just go back to basics, as the Honorable Elijah Muhammad said, and become producers. We can look at all of the things that we use and ask our colleges, why are not our young people being taught to produce these things for ourselves? And that's all that I'm going to say on that note now. And I'll turn it over to Brother Mustafa, and then after your comments, we'll close out.
Okay, wonderful, wonderful. Thank you very much. I want to say, in terms of this subject matter, that there's a good example of what this kind of independent thinking created in the Tuskegee Airmen. Now, despite that movie showing that they got some planes knocked down, they didn't get a single plane knocked down. They went in and they came out whooping German butt and they didn't get a single plane shot down. They saved and they escorted a lot of military expositions across the water and didn't lose a single one. But the movie had to depict a negative part to show that they lost some, and it wasn't true. So my point is this, is that the Tuskegee in the isolation during the early eras of the military formation here, they were forced to be by themselves, and they nurtured each other, and they protect each other, and they responded when it came time to respond, and they helped save this country, sir. That's why they're heroes, number one. Number two, I want to say the topic is a very powerful topic today, and I want to just give a little parlay, and this will be the end of what I'm talking about. Why the African-American community need HBCUs to continue to survive and prosper in the 21st century. I think the case has been stated quite clearly, sir, in what you presented and what I presented. But I want to take a step further to the future in making this as an addendum. Where there is a will, there is a way to create a new day beyond the 21st century. I'm going to repeat. Where there is a will, there is a way to create a new day beyond the 21st century. That's all I have to say.
Okay, well, that's fine. I do want to say this. I'd be remiss if I didn't mention this, and I hope that you can appreciate this. But one of the historians and archivists and the historian for the Tuskegee Airmen Association did some further research, and it appears, and I haven't validated it by doing the research myself, even though I am a military historian, I have not actually gone to the primary sources to validate this. But according to this particular historian for the Tuskegee Airmen Association, apparently there were several planes that were lost during engagements that the famous Tuskegee Airmen took part in. So we're going to do some more research on that and bring that information to you. But notwithstanding that, their record was certainly admirable, and the fact is that after several years of being held back from actively participating in the major engagements except for the fight for Anzio in Sicily that occurred in the beginning of the war, they were generally held back from a lot of the action that won Distinguished Flying Crosses and other great memorable achievements for the white pilots. But when they were given that opportunity to escort the bombers, these were white bombers. They didn't have the black bombers deployed to Europe at that time. So the people that were saved, the lives that were saved, the planes that were saved, the missions that were allowed to be successful because they did reach their targets and dropped their bombs on the German industries and so forth, it was because of the courage and the flying prowess and agility and skill of these black pilots. So I just wanted to say that I'm going to do the research myself as a military historian to find out really what did exist in the records of the Air Force concerning this particular claim that was withstood many decades, really, since it first began to be promoted until this historian, this black historian for the Tuskegee Airmen Association, refuted it with some information. But I'll double-check it. But that's not really the big thing. The big thing is that these black men showed that given the opportunity, the black person, the black man or woman has the necessary skills and talents to do anything that we really put our minds to. And this was a big thing because the War Department said that we as black people did not have the mental or physical coordination and agility to be able to fly these planes. Now, my father proved that to be wrong because he went through the training and qualified to fly fighter planes, and he was designated as a pilot. He was a lieutenant in the Army Air Forces, and he was qualified as a pilot. So just the fact that he did it, and I know his record personally because I have his service record right here in my house when he passed, and I inherited that. And so I have a record of his training showing that he was definitely qualified to fly fighter planes. And he was one of over 950, nearly 1,000 people during the war. And later, many that came afterwards, that proved beyond a shadow of a doubt that our people have the skill set, that have the ability to develop the skill set, I should say, to do all of these mechanical things that you have to do to fly an airplane. And so anyway, we definitely appreciate and we thank everyone who's listened, even if you didn't come online to speak tonight. We hope that you will share this with others. We're going to post it on my Facebook page, the link to it, which is Booker Washington Sr., great-grandson, as early, hopefully, as tomorrow. So those of you who are listening, would you please share this link with your friends so others can hear this discussion, and maybe next week, which we hope to continue this discussion. It's not a one-time thing. We can be talking about this for a lot of different sessions. Why do the black colleges and universities need to survive? Why does the black community need to have these schools survive? And I personally, as I in my comments, I believe they need to survive, but they need to survive only if they're going to help us to develop a sense of independence and productivity among ourselves so we can actually sit at the table as equal partners instead of just sitting at the end of the table watching for the crumbs to fall in our hands and hoping that we get a share. And this is what has been happening, particularly since integration, where we've been rushing to the white man's table, hoping that they would let us in the door to get whatever jobs they felt that we would be fit to do, and usually it was not to become the CEOs or to become on the boards of directors. Now you see that happening, but that is, to me, in my opinion, a fair exchange for the millions of people that are unemployed because we don't have industries set up to employ them. So I don't like to have the last word. I'm a person that likes to share the stage after I say my piece. So, Brother Halim, I'm going to give you the last word, and then we'll close.
Thank you, sir. Let me just say that the last shall be first, and the first shall be last, but only when they realize how to get the cash.
That sounds good to me. All right. Okay, well, thank you. We're going to give you all who are listening a nice little, what I would say, interlude of nice music as we finish. Good night, and thank you all for listening. We have appreciated knowing that some of you out there have participated by being our listeners, our audience tonight, and we wish you to have a content and happy weekend. God bless you all. Hope you'll join us next week, and good night.